So today we are going to start our lab lecture on the enthalpy of vaporization. Of ethanol. Exactly why we're doing this lab is going to be kind of hard to understand until we get through some of the background. So the end result is this enthalpy of vaporization, which is the amount of energy it's going to take to convert something from a liquid into a gas. But exactly why we're doing the measurements that we're doing is rather mathematical. So it's something I'm going to present to you at the end. What I'm going to tell you right off at the beginning is the way that we're going to do this experiment is to measure the vapor pressure of ethanol at several different temperatures. Because it turns out that vapor pressure and temperature and heat of vaporization are all related. I know that's a bit vague. I know that doesn't really give you enough context. But like I said, I'm going to have to build some of this background information first before you're really going to get what we're doing in this lab. So since this lab is about vapor pressure, since vapor pressure has come up in a lecture discussion more than once, I wanted to start out just with a little bit more extensive discussion of what vapor pressure is. So vapor pressure is the pressure of a gas automatically generated by a liquid due to the fact that a fraction of molecules have sufficient energy to evaporate. So, this diagram about to draw is the same one I've drawn several times now. It's what I refer to as the graph, and it is that energy distribution diagram that we use to say that not all the molecules are traveling at the same energy. Now, after this, hopefully we won't have to keep redrawing the diagram, but there was a variation of it we saw in lecture today. So, side by side, I want to draw the two versions of this energy distribution diagram that we've used, and one last time explain how we use these graphs and how they tie into this discussion of vapor pressure. So first, our axes here are number of molecules on the y-axis and energy per molecule on the x-axis. Now, because we've had this discussion of diffusion and effusion, it is energy per molecule that I'm showing here, not speed. Because, of course, at one temperature, the speed that a molecule travels is going to depend on its molar mass. So, putting aside any of that discussion, we're just going to call it energy. And as I've already done several times before, I'm going to show that the curve changes shape depending on temperature. So the curve flattens out, broadens out, and shifts to higher energy as temperature increases. So red is again higher or high temperature. Green is medium temperature. And blue is low temperature. Now, since we have this definite quantity of energy, the heat of vaporization that you have to cross in order to be able to evaporate, I'm going to put that specific amount of energy on the graph here. And then I'm going to shade in these areas of the graph that are past that line. These areas are going to represent the molecules that have enough energy in order to be able to evaporate. So the main point that I've made previously is just the fact that there are different molecules traveling at different speeds, different energies. And at any temperature, some fraction of molecules will have the energy to evaporate. But now, the point of this graph is also to show, as temperature increases, the fraction of molecules with enough energy to evaporate also increases. Now here at the bottom, and I have to remember, you can't tell that I'm just drawing this fresh. You're seeing the end result because I'm not at home. So in the second graph, it's still number of molecules. That's our y-axis. It's still energy per molecule. That's our x-axis. But now this graph is only a single temperature. And what I have on the graph are the heats of vaporization of three different molecules or three different substances. Now, because you are the section that is fortunate enough to have already had lecture, you know that these different heats of vaporization might be due to different amounts of intermolecular forces. So, for example, maybe what I'm labeling as heat of vaporization 3 might be the heat of vaporization for water, while down here in blue, maybe that's something like methane, something with very low heat of vaporization, low intermolecular forces. And then I've got an in-between case here. So I've got heat of vaporization 1, 2, and 3. Again, look at the fraction of molecules that would have enough energy to evaporate based on their heats of vaporization. So this is all happening at the same temperature. But this is why different substances have different boiling points. They take different amounts of energy. Can I mute everyone? You know, that background noise might be me, unfortunately. I will mute everyone just in case. I can also put the windows up. Oh, okay, hold on. Is that okay now, though, with the windows open? Okay, so let me finish off what I was going to say here. So I slipped up this morning and wrote this next statement incorrectly at first because I was looking at the graph, because you see the big area that's blue. But the reason the big area is blue is not because the heat of vaporization is large. It's because it's small. So it's less than heat of vaporization. Oh, I just realized something. I'm on mute because I'm recording on this laptop and it's going to feed back if I try to unmute you all. So I don't even know who's muted and unmuted. So just until I get back home, everybody, I'm so sorry. Please throw your questions to the chat window. So if you have your hand raised even, go ahead and throw your question to the chat window. I will see it, but I'm unable to listen at the moment because I don't have headphones with me. This all happened kind of in a hurry. So, heat of vaporization of 1 is less than heat of vaporization 2 is less than heat of vaporization 3. And so, at any specific temperature, the higher the heat of vaporization, the fewer the number of molecules that have the energy to evaporate. So now, let me try to put this back in the context of what we're supposed to be doing. We're going to be trying to measure the enthalpy of vaporization for a particular substance. So I've talked about how heat of vaporization is related to how many molecules can evaporate in this last graph. And so later on, we're going to relate boiling point to heat of vaporization. Now, the first graph here, you could see that the amount of vapor generated under vapor pressure changes with temperature, and you can see the number of molecules involved is again determined by heat of vaporization. So that's why I'd said that if we measure the heat of vaporization at different temperatures, there's a mathematical way we're going to be able to get the heat of vaporization. So I know you still don't know why or how we're doing that, but at least we've had this discussion of what vapor pressure is. So, again, I apologize that I'm not able to take verbal questions just for the moment, unless I do this. The question was asked, which direction is heat going on the graph? And the answer is nowhere. This is representing what different energy molecules there would be in a sample where that's all at the same temperature. The point of temperature is it does not correspond to a single energy a single molecular energy, it corresponds to a distribution. So the second graph, the one that's at the bottom, that one, navigating back to my notes, there we go. That's at a temperature. So there's no heat involved, there's no movement of energy. This is just all about what would happen if different molecules had different heats of vaporization. All right. Can you explain what it means to say the higher the heat of vaporization, the fewer yes. So let me highlight this portion of the graph momentarily. So this part that's in blue here, and oh, you can't see me highlight because of the internet. So wait, I can do this though. One moment. Where's my annotation tool? Oh, I think I turned off annotations. Darn it. Okay, so if you look at the blue versus the green versus the red represents the molecules that have enough energy for that substance to evaporate. The green represents the molecules for that substance. The blue for that substance. More molecules are in that blue area because it has a low barrier to evaporation. Very few molecules in red have enough energy because of its high heat of vaporization. So that's what that statement means. The higher the heat of vaporization, as we go in this example from blue to green to red, the fewer number of molecules, less area shaded, that have the energy to be able to evaporate. Okay, any more questions? And again, for technical reasons, I'm not able to take questions verbally at the moment. Well, then let me move you on to page 2. Oh, I just got super smart. This is actually what we're looking at live now, because I've somehow updated, I think. How did I? That's a neat trick. Okay, so now let me do this. Here we go. Oh, I know. This is the most bizarre class I think I will ever teach, being stuck in the car like this. So, now this next topic. You know what? Let me try something really quickly here. Because my iPad does have an internet connection, it's just not connecting well enough to share, but will it update you? Is this your weirdest class? No, I guess not. I mean, there have been more difficult classes just because of things that may be going on at the time, but I think sitting in my car waiting for someone in the doctor's office while I'm on my iPad stealing a Xfinity connection from who knows where, that's pretty different for me. So even though this might work, I'm going to do this instead. I'm just going to show you the end result, and I'm trying to write it a little more neatly as we go. Because one question that could come up is this. If the vapor pressure depends on temperature, well, how do you measure that pressure? To get at the real point I'm making is this. The way I introduced the topic of vapor pressure is to say, what if I spilt a few drops of water somewhere? And then that's when I started to explain that the water can evaporate even though it's nowhere near its boiling point, because some fraction of molecules have the energy to be able to evaporate. Of course, in this case of water evaporating, it's out in an open environment. So it just keeps evaporating, evaporating, evaporating until it all disappears. But it turns out that if you do this in a closed container, the vapor pressure only reaches a certain maximum pressure. And so that's why this next discussion we're going to have is on the topic of equilibrium. So let me, because you can already see everything that was written, let me explain this step by step. Let's say that we start out with a vacuum. Give myself some more room. Which means we've completely emptied out that container. There's absolutely nothing in it. Let's say that this was Star Trek, so we had teleporters. Which means somehow we could magically transport water into this container. We're going to do a less impossible thing in lab. There's a way to replicate roughly the same behavior. But that's why I'm describing it the way I am. To say, imagine somehow, ideally, the water could just suddenly levitate into the container. Once it's in the container, the liquid water, that is, what's going to happen? And again, sorry if you want to answer, please throw it to the chat window. Does T represent time? So yes, what I'm going to say is that right here, right after the water is added in, we will call that time equal to zero. Well, you can already see the answer there, that there's some arrows here. But what do you think those arrows represent? Vapor. which is the vapor pressure that's being generated. Again, this whole discussion on the previous page about the fraction of molecules that have enough energy to be able to evaporate. Well, they're starting to evaporate. But this is right at the instant that the water has been put in. So there's not any condensation going on yet because you don't have any gas. But you know, just even an instant after this whole process starts, that means in addition to gas molecule, or in liquid water, you're going to have gas as well, vapor. And because there's so much water, maybe it won't really change the rate at which the evaporation's going much, but you're now going to have some condensation. And this I'll call T not equal to zero, because any time after the beginning, you're going to have water and vapor around. Now, because this whole discussion is going to come up again when we address the chemical version of equilibrium later, I'm going to label this first box 1, the second box 2, because it makes a lot of sense. Would it surprise anybody to know there will be a third box? But I'm going to need another little bit of space here, so I'm going to rewrite things to make more space. So where on the notes you're looking at, it says plus H2O. I'm just rewording it a little bit to say add liquid water, because I was able to squeeze some more space out of doing it. So now we get to what happens when this thing sits around for a long time. In other words, T equals infinity, let's say. Well, more and more of the vapor is going to keep on evaporating. But there's something else that's going to happen as well. Now, for those of you not taking electronic notes, it hit me this morning that the way I'm going to be writing notes from now on is going to start changing because I can move things around if I want to. But for those of you writing with traditional pen and paper, that might get a little annoying. So if you look at the bottom of this page, there's a graph there. I have it at the bottom of the page because everything above it relates to the diagram above it. But I'm going to start out in the middle of the page here and move it later. So I'm just letting you know. It's going to end up at the bottom. And as you can see, it's another version of the graph. But it looks a little different than the ones we've seen before. And I'll explain why. Because this graph, I know it's not labeled as such, is going to represent the vapor phase. The water that's already been turned into vapor. Still number of molecules on the y-axis. Still the energy per mole on the x-axis. We still have the heat of vaporization that's going to dictate how many molecules are able to evaporate. But now, instead of shading what's on the right-hand side, which is what's been the case so far, notice now I'm shading the left-hand side. Why? Because that area represents the fraction of molecules, fraction of gas particles not fraction is what you're reading there, a fraction of gas particles. That do not have the energy to remain in the gas phase. So, in other words, this is the fraction of molecules that condense. Think about this. For those of you who maybe just rationalize it this way, that we're not actively in a drought anymore, per se. And so if you take that 5-10 minute shower, hot shower at the beginning of the day because you need something to make it possible for you to tolerate taking chemistry that day or whatever it is, If you stay in that shower long enough, you know that you're going to get steam that's going to condense and drip off of everything, right? This is the graph that explains this, the one in the purple, because that represents those molecules that do not have the energy to be able to stay in the gas phase. So now, let me come back up to this equilibrium discussion, because the whole reason I broke out to that discussion is in what I call box three here, which is where you let unlimited amount of time go past. Eventually, enough molecules of the liquid water are going to evaporate that there are going to be enough molecules in the vapor phase that won't have the energy to stay in the vapor, that rate of condensation is going to become equal. And that is equilibrium. So let's write that out, what I have so far. And as I promised, I'm going to move this out of the way. Okay, so stage one of this whole discussion, that's where the liquid water is magically added into the container. And so only liquid water is present. So only evaporation can occur. Again, in box two, as soon as any evaporation does occur, condensation will also begin to occur. Then moving on. Eventually, enough vapor forms that the rate of condensation will equal the rate of evaporation. And as I said, that is exactly this situation, which is called equilibrium. Equilibrium is all about energy balance, meaning that the reason nothing is evaporating or condensing anymore is that there's also no energy change observably going on. It's not that they stop evaporating, condensing. It's just that they don't make any headway. You don't change, if you wanted to use that language, reactants and products. If you call the liquid reactant, the steam, the products, you get to a point where the molecules are just as happy being in equal form because the forms are equal energy. That's equilibrium. Of course, that is also something we can use to describe chemical reactions. Whether something wants to go forward and convert from reactants to products or from products to reactants, that depends on the energy balance. So we're going to be talking a lot more about equilibrium later on. Now, let's imagine one more situation. And hold on, everyone, while I again give myself a little more room. Okay, so I'm drawing the fourth box, because if you are looking at the notes, you say, well, Dr. A, what about that fourth box that's there? So getting to that fourth box, what if we already had this system at equilibrium, where everything was at balance? What if we broke that balance and suddenly add steam? Well, then you're going to have an excess of gas particles compared to what there should be at equilibrium. And what that's going to mean is you have more condensation. But you didn't add any liquid water, so the amount of evaporation is going to remain the same. But that means overall, more of it's going to condense until, of course, enough of that water condenses where the rate of condensation drops, and again, the rate of condensation and evaporation are equal to each other. Let me write all that out. And yes, anyone that's joining in late, the notes that you're looking at are ones taken from this morning, because the internet connection I'm on right now in my car is not letting me share my iPad quickly enough live. So I'm talking about what has already been written. I'm writing it fresh, which is why it's taking a while, because I'm making it a little bit neater than what you're looking at. And also, there are some students that are doing it the traditional way, where you're writing where I'm talking. So you need time. So let me write this out. If steam is suddenly added to the container after equilibrium is reached, if steam is added to the container after equilibrium is reached, the rate of condensation will exceed evaporation. Liquid will therefore form I'll say with a better word maybe liquid will therefore condense until the rates of evaporation and condensation equal each other again. In other words, if you disturb a system in equilibrium, that system will try to respond in such a way that it resists that change and it returns back to equilibrium. Which, if any of you have had more advanced chemistry before, what I just stated was Le Chatelier's principle. So this whole 1, 2, 3, 4 discussion, like I said, is going to come up again later on in the quarter. Now, right before our break, we wrapped up our discussion of equilibrium, but I wanted to summarize it in a way that relates it back to the lab, this whole discussion. So here's what I had said this morning. In a closed container at a fixed temperature, evaporation of a liquid will stop once vapor pressure is reached. Because this lab is supposed to be determining the heat of vaporization by measuring vapor pressure. So this now explains that if we were to put a liquid into a sealed container, it's going to reach a maximum pressure, which is that vapor pressure. So now I can explain a little bit better how we would do this lab. Now you still don't really know the connection. That's the mathematical part, and that's the part that we'll do last. So let me go ahead and draw a rough version of what your experimental setup would have looked like. Let me do a better job than that. There we go. So imagine that you have an Erlenmeyer flask, but one that has a stopper on it, but one where that stopper has two hoses that are stuck through it. One of those hoses is attached to a pressure gauge. So you can monitor the pressure that's inside that container. And then the other one is hooked up to a valve where you can let things in and out, but therefore you could also seal the container off, which means you're going to keep it closed, which means it's going to be able to reach equilibrium. So in this experiment, a liquid sample is added to a sealed container and then allowed to achieve equilibrium. The pressure and the temperature of the container are measured before and after the liquid is added. So let's assume for the easy case, the temperature didn't change. That means the difference in pressure measured is the vapor pressure of that liquid at that temperature. So adding a little bit of liquid here. Then let me make that last statement again. The difference in pressure measured is the vapor pressure of the liquid. Assuming, again, the temperature stays the same. So the last detail, then, is how do we physically carry this out? So, of course, we can't put this on a complete vacuum. We do have a vacuum system, Deanza, but not anywhere strong enough to create the type of vacuum I was talking about in my equilibrium example. And then, I just lost my train of thought. Of course, you can't teleport. I mean, if we had that, wow. So we wouldn't be wasting that just on teleporting liquids around, would we? Right? So we're going to have to do as close as we can, which is this. You open up the valve, you put the pressure gauge stopper thing on the container, you keep the valve open a bit so that you allow the system to reach equilibrium with just air, and then you close off the valve. You get a syringe that you fill with ethanol, and then you attach that syringe to the valve. You then inject a certain amount of liquid in, and you pull the same volume of air out as the volume of liquid that you just added in, so that you try not to affect the baseline pressure that's in that system. And if you do that quickly before it really has a chance to evaporate, well, then you can let it, you can seal it off, let it start evaporating, reach that equilibrium vapor pressure. In fact, if I can go back and go to the first page of notes again. I want to add a word there, because I said that vapor pressure is the pressure of a gas automatically generated. It is. But because we've now had this whole long discussion, I want to say it is the equilibrium pressure of a gas automatically generated by a liquid. So that will show up on your end in just a moment here. Come on, great internet, you can do it. Well, okay, so where it says E right now, oh, there we go, equilibrium, yay. Okay, so now let's go back to what we were discussing, which is how this lab is physically occurring. So let me write down what we would do. The liquid is added by syringe through the valve to maintain a closed system. I don't want to say system because this is not a perfectly isolated system, and I don't want to get as confused with thermodynamics right now, so let me say it this way. The liquid is added by syringe to maintain a closed container. A volume of air equal to the volume of liquid added is removed to maintain the initial pressure of the container. And why I'm writing some of these details down may make more sense when we go over the more full calculations, because it's going to turn out we're going to run out of time in order to really complete the calculations today. So it will finish updating in a moment here, but this is the third page of notes. The last thing to do is for us to get to the point, which is, what is this manipulation of data we're going to do? How are we going to get this heat of vaporization of ethanol? So any questions before I move on to the next page? Okay, so last quarter, you got your introduction to the topic of thermodynamics, which is about energy changes and energy distributions, not just in chemical, but also in mechanical systems. There is a form of thermodynamics, which is called statistical thermodynamics. And let me explain what this is about a little bit. I'll do this without writing. We can have things like Boyle's Law, Charles' Law, these different relationships that we can observe macroscopically. But what if we wanted to try to explain what was going on down at the molecular level? And so what you could do if you have good enough math is to come up with a way of representing this system of however many billions and billions and billions of particles, but to come up with such an elegant math that it can still come up with the same predictions based on how all those molecules interact that you might get from just measuring it real life in lab. So it's a statistical way of taking molecular behavior and getting it to equal real-life observation. And that is something known as statistical mechanics. So in statistical mechanics, there is a type of an equation that is called a partition function. And I'm not going to try to go into the details of that much. It's just I know some of you will hear that expression again one day. I'm going to write a generalized version of the expression. And then I will explain it, or translate it, I should say, into English. So what is this? This equation gives the number of particles that have at least a particular energy at a given temperature. Let me highlight to emphasize where these things show up in the equation. So N represents the number of particles. E is going to represent the energy, EX. And T is going to be temperature. Now there's several different equations, important equations in chemistry, that all have the same exponential format. If you've had kinetics before, because you've had a more advanced chemistry class, you might have heard of the Arrhenius expression. It's an expression where it's identical to this, except it's talking about how many molecules have enough energy to react, and that EX is called EA, the activation energy. A lot of scary math, and another version of this equation comes from what is known as the Clausius-Clapeyron equation. If you try to go look this up on something like Wikipedia, you get a much scarier math than what I'm about to show you, because it can be applied more generally in thermodynamics. But if you use the equation and simplify it, you get this. And so notice that's the same mathematical format. It's just that now instead of number of molecules, we have P, which is going to be the vapor pressure. Then we already recognize this delta HVAP as the enthalpy or heat of vaporization. Of course, T is temperature, and R, well, it's related to the gas constant, but it's what I'm going to call the thermodynamic constant. And that's because there are different sets of units that we use for R in an expression like this than we would use in the ideal gas equation. So I know I have never discussed units because we haven't worked that many problems in class, but R usually has the units of liters atmospheres per Kelvin mole. And that's the one that has the value of 0.082059. This thermodynamic number, I'm embarrassed. I don't know the units offhand without looking. I should. I even have forgotten its value for certainty. I think it's 8.314 something. But in other words, it's a different value. And later on, if we really care, I can show you how to convert from one to the other. But now, let's do some math. So we're going to start with this Clausius-Clapeyron equation, the simplified form. And I'm going to take the natural log of each side. Now, I left one little thing out because I didn't want to get too sidetracked by it. There's this little constant that ends up in there, too. So I'm going to throw a constant in front of this Clausius-Clapeyron equation, which means I need to put it down here as well. So there we go. Now, let me rewrite this a little bit, because natural log of pressure will now equal the natural log of two things. Turns out that if you have, and let me write this out to the side, if you have natural log of A times B, you can rewrite that as the natural log of A plus the natural log of B. So if I have natural log of C times blah, 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 I can have natural log of blah, 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 blah. And then natural log of C. Okay, natural log of E raised to a power is the power itself. So now I get natural log of P is equal to E to the negative vapor heat of vaporization over RT plus natural log of C. Well, I'm going to rewrite it one last way. I'm going to pull temperature. Oh, what am I doing? I'm so sorry. That is completely wrong. There's no E in there because I took the natural log. So it should be simply negative heat of vaporization over RT plus C. And I just realized I'm not looking at my chat window. Hold on. Okay. So let me take that 1 over T and separate it out. So I ended up with natural log of P is equal to negative heat of vaporization over R times 1 over T plus natural log of C. Okay, now math happens again. And this is what's known as substitution of variables. What if, for reasons that will become more clear in just a moment, I take natural log of P and I replace that with the label Y? Let's say that this whole negative heat of vaporization over R, I rename that M. 1 over T, what if I call it X? And then natural log of C, what if that turns into B? Well, that means I now have an equation with the format Y equals MX plus B, which in other words means we have a straight line. Gee, Dr. Gray, that's really neat you have a straight line. Why is the C included? Because science. Was that good? Okay. Not to be insulting. It's because I didn't do this whole explanation really properly enough, but it's good enough to get to the point, and I can try to get around to that C some other time. It's not truly important, other than to say that I've gotten to what is the traditional log form of the Clausius-Clapeyron equation. Maybe another way to say it is there's an integral that all this comes from, and if you know anything about integrals, if you go backwards and take a derivative, you end up with a constant. There are no integrals here because I didn't do it that way, because that's way beyond the level of this class, but that's actually the answer to where that C comes from. So, okay, what I mean by the substitution of variables is this. If we plot natural log of pressure, not pressure, natural log of pressure as the y-axis, and then 1 over temperature as the x-axis, that automatically means that the slope here is going to be equal to negative heat of vaporization over R. This is finally the whole point of the lab, that by plotting vapor pressure at different temperatures, we can come up with this graph that gives us a physically meaningful slope. And to just write it down in statement form, by measuring the vapor pressure at different temperatures, the heat of vaporization can be determined. From the slope of this graph. That will update in just a moment. And that is the whole point of the lab, to come up with the heat of vaporization of ethanol. So next time, we'll do the actual calculations. Don't pack up yet because we got a couple minutes left. But we're not going to do the full set of calculations today. Right now, I'm just waiting for this to update so you can write the last bit of that sentence. There you go. Let's see. Could pressure be negative? And do you have to include the absolute value for the natural log? No, it can't be negative. At least not by physics that we study. So you don't have to worry about an absolute sign. Okay. Now, this whole lab, I've been talking about it being the measurement of the vapor pressure of ethanol. Maybe we should take a minute to talk about the substance ethanol. Because I'm supposed to talk about lab safety. And then there's another story connected with ethanol I want to talk about. Before I can get to the ethanol, I have to do something else. And unfortunately, because this connection doesn't update very quickly, you may not see this until I'm done writing. But if you can imagine what I'm doing now, I'm writing a series of carbon atoms all in a chain. Oh, good, you can see some of it already. And it's going to be 18 carbons total, 8 on the left, a pair of carbons double bonded in the middle, and it's going to be 8 more carbons on the right-hand side. This compound that I'm drawing is the substance oleic acid, which is one of the principal components of olive oil. It is what can be incorporated into what are known as unsaturated fats. And that unsaturation refers to the fact that there is a carbon-carbon double bond in this molecule, which is more reactive than any of the carbon-carbon single bonds. So, in other words, it gives a place in the molecule for reactivity to occur. It is a total pain to draw in the style of structure that you all have learned how to draw in Chem 1A, because there's just this massive number of hydrogens and carbons and bonds and all these things that you have to draw. And then there's these things that we call line structures. And the line structure version of the same molecule looks like this. Which, once it appears on the page, you're going to say, wow, it's a heck of a lot simpler. It's almost complete. It's missing a little bit on the right. There we go. So, what did I do here? Well, it focuses on the fact, this way of writing structures, it focuses on the carbon framework of the molecule, because that's what a line structure is meant to do. It's a way of simplifying writing of organic molecules so it doesn't take all day to write them down. Because yes, some molecules are small, like the ethanol I'm going to draw. A heck of a lot of common biological molecules are big monsters. So you need some kind of way of writing these molecules more efficiently. So now let's talk about how to read these line structures. Line structures are based on the assumption that carbon is tetravalent. And what that tetravalent means is that it has four attachments or connections of some kind. So, better way to say it is that it has four bonds and or lone pairs. And those are bonds or lone pairs of different types. So, in a line structure, any missing connections are presumed to be hydrogens. So if you look at the line structure that I drew, and you look at the original molecule that's above it, on the very left-hand side of the line structure, we have an atom that only has a single connection on it. And that means that there has to be three hydrogens there to make up for that fact. The next carbon over has two connections to it, but that means that there are two hydrogens that are going to have to be drawn in the full structure, and this will update in just a moment. And then on the right-hand side, we can see that where the oxygens are, that carbon there already has four bonds of a type drawn to it. You have two single and a double. And so you can see there are no hydrogens attached to that carbon in the molecule up above. So that just gives you an idea how to write line structures. And so that lets me easily write out the structure for ethanol. Now, having drawn the line structure, I'll expand it out into the old style structure so I can make sure you know that you're reading it correctly. Now, this OH group in ethanol is not a hydroxide group because it's not ionic. And it turns out at any carbon molecule where you put that OH group on it is going to behave the same way. And so there's something known as a functional group. And that is a pattern of atoms that has predictable behavior regardless of the molecule it's located on. And so, this functional group is known as an alcohol. Which, yes, ethanol is the alcohol that is in alcoholic beverages. You have seen other functional groups before, just above in oleic acid, and here in acetic acid, which I've drawn the line structure for. These are both molecules that contain what are called carboxylic acids. And that is another kind of functional group. Okay, so some of you might be thinking, oh goody, that means I could have had ethanol if I went to lab, if we really had lab. Well, no, because you would have in lab used what's called denatured ethanol. And what is denatured ethanol? Ethanol that has additives to it so it cannot be consumed. It might be toluene, which is a hydrocarbon that's not something you want to drink. Or it could even be something like methanol, something that causes blindness. Why would they do that? Two reasons. So we don't have labs full of drunk students and instructors. But the other reason is taxation. Because if you have ethanol, even for chemical purposes, that's pure enough for consumption, it's taxed just like the ethanol in the alcohol stores. But if you denature it, if you add something to it where it cannot be consumed, it's not taxed like normal ethanol. In the lab, when I was in grad school, if we needed the really pure stuff for some particular reason, you had to show your ID, you had to sign out for it, it was kept in a cage, it was a big production. If you needed the stuff as a solvent that it didn't matter, it had a little poison in it, you used the denatured stuff and it was right on the shelf. So I talk about this because it's a practical crossover between society and chemistry. What kind of ethanol would you really have used in lab? Since this is all about lab safety, the point would have been, I would have told you in lab, don't drink the ethanol.